This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello! Welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan, and this is the show that does exactly what the title says. We discover all the most amazing, wondrous, and often just plain weird things that are out there in the universe. Today, we are learning about the dinosaur that's more dangerous than the T-Rex. We'll find out why everybody is always telling you you need to drink more water. And in a sec, we will talk to a professor in Canada about why he's studying a dead whale's heart. First, we're travelling to the past, way back in the past, to find out which dinosaurs are better, herbivores or carnivores.
Travel back in time to the age of the dinosaur
at the Natural History Museum.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the age of the dinosaur. The Jurassic period was home to thousands of different dinosaurs, big and small. One easy way to learn about them is to split them into two groups: the meat-eaters, or carnivores, and the plant-eaters, or herbivores. Of course, some dinosaurs are both. Look out! Here comes a well-known carnivore, the Megalosaurus.
He's getting very close, and he's enormous!
Megalosaurus was a terrifying predator that was almost 9 meters long. That's twice as high as a double-decker bus. He had powerful jaws and sharp teeth, perfect for ripping through his prey's thick skins and swallowing huge chunks of flesh. His teeth were serrated. That means zigzag-shaped along the edge, like a saw, and could slice through flesh easily. Standing on his hind legs, with short forearms and a huge head, he looked quite like Tyrannosaurus. Although since T-Rex wasn't to appear for many millions of years, they would never have met. As well as razor-sharp teeth and strong jaws, predators have large eyes for finding their prey. We can tell this in dinosaur fossils from the shape of the bones in the skull, which reveal the size of the eyes. The eyes would have faced slightly forward, like in a bird of prey. This allowed them to judge distances accurately, helping with hunting.
Ugh, what's that horrible smell?
Another sign of a meat eater is found in their brains, whose impressions are left deep in the skull. The part of the brain involved in smelling was very large in carnivores. Many meat-eating dinosaurs would eat dead animals as well as live ones, so sniffing out rotting carcasses, sometimes as much as a kilometer away, was important.
Watch out, there's some giant feet heading this way.
You might think the herbivores sound a bit less scary, but they were some of the hugest creatures that ever lived. Diplodocus is one of the best-known herbivores, a huge sauropod who stood a whopping 26 meters long with a long neck, perfect for reaching leaves at the top of tall trees. Lots of herbivores had many rows of teeth, sometimes pencil-shaped to rake the vegetation, other times rounder or blunt-like spoons to rip leaves from the branches. Teeth were constantly replaced as they broke or wore down, which would have happened a lot. To get enough vegetation to keep their huge bodies going, those teeth would have been busy. Whilst broad-snouted sauropods wouldn't have been picky eaters, those dinosaurs with narrower mouths could pick particular plants, and so may have had a favourite. Others, like the Stegosaurus, had horny beaks that could slice through the toughest vegetation.
Paleontology. Pick.
How can paleontologists be so sure about what dinosaurs ate? Well as the shape of their skeletons, size of stomach cavities and the type of teeth, there's another way. Because what goes in must come out. That's right, fossil poo. Called a coprolite, it can help scientists understand the relationships between animals and plants. Seeds, bones, fish scales, or vegetation can be identified and give us an accurate picture of what a dinosaur liked to eat. Travel back in time to the age of the dinosaur.
The new interactive exhibition at the Natural History Museum. Walk alongside life-size moving animatronic dinosaurs and other strange creatures among the smells and sounds of the prehistoric Jurassic swamps and Cretaceous deserts. Find out more at nhm.ac.uk.
But watch out for what's around the corner.
Remember, all of our Age of Dinosaurs series is free for you to download on your phone and tablet on iTunes, on the Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com. We'll be on the phone to some geniuses in Canada in just a sec, finding out what they can possibly be doing with a dead whale's heart. First, I want to say a big hello to Max Buckley, who listens to every single episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly on a trip to Wales the other day. It's quite funny, Max, because we're learning about a different type of Wales in just a sec, not the country, I hope. Well, that was a very odd trip you took, Max. Anyway, thanks for saying hello. Also, a massive shout out to Zoe, who is loving the show. Thanks, Zoe. Remember, if you want a shout out next week, the easiest way to get one is to leave us a review on iTunes. All you need to do, get out your phone or your tablet and type in the Fun Kids Science Weekly onto the App Store or Google Play. Let us know what you think. Leave your name. Next week, I might be saying hello to you. Now, some genius scientists in Canada, they've done something incredibly rare, and they've managed to salvage the heart of a dead whale. It's the biggest one that's ever been kept, and Mark Enstrom is the Deputy Director of Collections and Research at the Royal Ontario Museum, and he can tell us loads more. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, very well, thank you. What about over there? So tell me all about what you've managed to find.
Well, we've, just like in the Natural History Museum in London, we have a very large blue whale skeleton. As a matter of fact, they're almost exactly the same size. And when we salvaged our blue whale recently, we also salvaged the heart, as you mentioned. And it is the largest heart ever preserved from any mammal. And it's on display right now at the museum.
So if it's the largest ever preserved, that surely means you've been able to look at it in more detail than you have ever before. What have you found out that maybe you didn't know?
Well, there's lots of things about this whale, the whale heart, that are very interesting for us. And it just, whenever you do anything about science, you think you're answering questions when you look at something, and it always raises 1,000 more questions. So when we've been able to examine this heart, we've seen some interesting things. It's not the same shape as a human heart, for example. It's really kind of, it's actually more symmetrical than a human heart. That is, the two chambers on the bottom, the ventricles, are about the same size. So it looks more like an apple than an upside down pear, and the heart is currently collapses when it was in the whale when we salvaged it, and we think there's quite a bit of that. The heart probably at least partially collapses when it dived, and so it has to, maybe one of the ventricles is very large compared to a human because it's storing blood during a dive. We're trying to answer those kinds of questions by looking at more heart.
And how are you doing experiments on this heart? Because if people can come down to the museum and see it? How are you kind of finding the time to have a deeper look into what's going on?
Well, we had a deeper look when we actually did the preservation in the first place. And of course, and there recently was a series of right whales that died off the coast of east coast of Canada, and we were able to look at some more heart there. But while it's on display, we can look at the structure of the heart while it's on display, but it's when it comes off, we'll be able to take a little bit more of a deep look at it. But it's really through getting a series of these hearts that we'll start to learn more about the adaptation that whales have for in their hearts for accommodating deep dive.
Put it in terms that I would understand, Mark. How big is it?
It's really big. So it's about the size of a smart car. It's about 5 feet high and 4 feet wide and 4 feet deep.
And it's just like hanging there in your museum right now?
It's sitting there on a stand. You can come see it, and we actually have opened up a little window so you can actually see inside of it as well.
This is the first one that's ever been preserved. Why has it taken you so long to get one that's in it that you can keep in a brilliant condition so you can study?
Because you have to be a bit crazy to salvage one. They're so big and they're so hard to preserve. So we did a process called plastination, and the process is you replace all the fluid that's in the cells with a silicon polymer, it took us about a year and a half to actually do the preservation. So it takes a very long time with a lot of volume of silicon and special facilities. So not everybody would think about taking this task on.
What's strange I find is that the heart of a whale, one of the biggest creatures in the world, has the same name as the heart of a mouse, one of the smallest. How are they different, though? How has the heart of this whale evolved differently to kind of let it cope with what goes on under the sea?
Well, that's very interesting, because as I said, it's very, you know, the shape is very different, and, you know, when it's doing something to store blood during deep dives. But the interesting, there's a lot of interest, there's a lot of differences when you look at scale. So if you have a mouse heart, we actually have a mouse heart on display, so you can compare them. It's tiny. It almost would fit on the head of a pin. It pumps a drop of blood every time it pumps, and it pumps about 600 times a minute or more. It beats about 600 times a minute or more. Whereas a blue whale heart is really big. It only pumps about 10 times a minute, or 10 or 12 times a minute. But when it pumps about 600 liters in each beat. So there's a big consequences of scale in terms of how fast it beats and the volume.
Say, for instance, I don't want to get too gross with this, but the heart maybe the heart started beating too quickly or too slowly. What would you notice about the way the whale was acting down in the sea if that changed?
Well, the whale probably decrease the rate with the heart beats when it dives. And so then what the whale will do is it'll be delivering blood only to the most essential organs, like the brain and the liver and to the heart itself. And it will be decreasing the blood flow to other parts of the body. And so it's like you're being up in really cold weather, your hands start to get numb because your body is not pumping so much blood to your extremities as it is to other parts of your body. And the whale adapts that way when it dives. So there's lots of really cool things going on when it speeds up or slows down its heart rate.
So I know that you've got it out for show over there and that you've been studying it quite thoroughly over the last few years. What are you still hoping to kind of find out in future studies?
Well,
with the whale?
Again, like I said, dude, this the whale heart opened up many more questions by seeing this one and seeing the structure of it. We find out that it's really, really cool, and there's tons of things that we don't know. And we don't know exactly what it's doing during these really deep dives when it's undergoing lots of pressure. We think the heart is partially collapsing. We're trying to figure out where the blood goes, and we're trying to understand better what's going on with the unusual shape of the heart. Like I said, it's the two chambers are the same size, whereas in all land mammals, the one chamber is much bigger than the other because one is pumping blood to the whole body, and the other chamber is just pumping blood to the lungs, which are right next door. So that chamber tends to be much smaller. Whereas a whale, it's really different. So something that's really interesting is going on. And we also think there's a lot of empty vessels and so on inside in the wall of the heart, and there may be some blood storage there too. So there's lots of questions to answer, and we're hoping to see even more of these structures so that we get a better handle on it.
Perfect. I'm so excited to hear the big answers for the huge questions that have come from this gigantic heart. Mark Engstrom, well, thank you so much for coming on the Fool.
You're welcome, and I hope your audience realizes that there's so much more to do in science, that every one of your listeners should become a scientist, because we've got lots and lots and lots more questions to answer.
Perfect. Mark, thanks so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you.
Now it's the part of the show where we learn about the most deadly things in the whole universe. And we're travelling way back in time for this week's Dangerous Dan to the Cretaceous period to see the most dangerous dinosaur ever. Because when you think of dinosaurs, you think of the T-Rex, right? When really, you should be thinking of the Spinosaurus. This beast was even bigger than the T-Rex, just as nasty as well. Scientists think it was the largest meat-eater to ever roam the Earth. It's a tall lizard. It was 18 metres long, it stands on two legs, and it's got loads of spikes joined together that stick out of its back and look a bit like a sail from a boat. And these could grow 10 times in length when they were attacking prey. And to help keep its balance and also to smash stuff up, it's got a really long swinging tail at the back. It would eat all sorts as well. Fish, small animals, other dinosaurs if it fancied. To help with that, it had the same head as a crocodile too. A long, incredibly strong jaw with a set of dagger-sharp teeth. When you think of the Spinosaurus, you should keep in mind the crocodile, because this was like a gigantic prehistoric crocodile. It didn't just use its huge jaw and smashing tail to hunt for food on land. It would dive under the sea as well. That is the reason why this beast is so dangerous. You couldn't escape the Spinosaurus anywhere. So if you've been onto my page over at funkidslive.com and you've sent in a question for me to ask our Science Weekly expert, stay right there. He might answer it in just a sec. First, we're catching up with another genius. It's Professor Hallux, who's just opened up a hydration help desk. He's telling us all about why we need water, where we get it from, if it's safe, if it's not. Today, he's telling us why drinking it is so important.
Hallux's hydration help desk. Call accepted.
Hello, Professor. I know we need water to survive, but why? What do our bodies want with all this water?
That's a great question. Water is absolutely vital to our survival. You can go without food for a number of weeks, but only a few days without a drink. And that's because we humans are made of so much of the stuff. 60 to 70% of our weight is water. It's in every cell of the body. Isn't that right, Nanobot?
It certainly is, Professor. Blood is over 90% water. The brain, heart and muscles are 75% water. Skin is 65% water. And even bones, which we think are very dry, well, they're 30% water.
And the younger you are, the higher those percentages are. Let's see some of the work water does. Water in the body's cells help to carry nutrients around and to also remove waste products. And because the waste ends up, well, you know where, we constantly need to replace the water in our bodies. Did you know we lose water when we breathe out? The misty water vapour you see in the air on chilly days is tiny drops of the stuff. Another important job water does in our bodies is to help keep us at a comfortable and healthy temperature. If our bodies get too hot, our brains instruct our bodies to start to sweat. These water droplets on our skin take the heat away as they evaporate, which helps us to cool down. That's why you might get thirsty when it's particularly hot. You're losing all that water in your body through your skin. If it's super hot and you're using lots of energy, you could lose as much as a litre every hour. That's why it's important to drink regularly. Right. Got any other facts for us, Nanobot?
Of course. I'm a positive well of watery wonderment. Some species of turtles and toads have special bladders which can hold water for many months, even years. This way, if the animal becomes short of water supplies, it can absorb water back from these special pockets.
Amazing, but we're not turtles or toads and we can't store water for that long. Because of the way our bodies work, we need to drink water frequently for us to stay in good health. And here are two terms we're going to be using a lot on the help desk.
Well hydrated and dehydrated.
When we have enough to drink, we are said to be well hydrated. And when we don't have enough, we're dehydrated. Hydration just means the amount of water in something. You might have heard grown-ups using those words. We'll find out more about them next time. Thanks for calling.
Hallux's Hydration Help Desk, with support from the Children's Health Fund. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Hallux.
You can download loads more Professor Hallux adventures and all of our brilliant Fun Kids Science series on iTunes, on the Fun Kids app and over at funkidslive.com for free. Time for something brand new on the Fun Kids Science Weekly then, where you can get any science question that you want answered. It can be anything, I promise. Doesn't matter how stupid it is. You might want to know why some food tastes really weird, but for some reason you like it. Maybe you want to know why the sky is blue, how far away the sun is. It doesn't matter. Just let me know what the question is over at funkidslive.com. Then I'll get our resident expert, Engineer Tom, to answer it for you. This has been sent in by Daniel, who is 18, who asks, why does Saturn have rings?
Well, firstly, I guess I should explain what the rings of Saturn are. So they are small bits of ice and rock. The reason they appear as rings is because each type of ice and rock tends to group together, which is why we see the rings. So where did the ice and the rock come from? Well, one theory is that Saturn had a lot of moons, and these moons, they had so many that they smashed together, and that's what formed the ice and rock in the rings. Another theory is that there was just a lot of ice and rock when Saturn was formed, and some of it didn't actually go into the planet itself and just stayed on the outside.
Why do they stay on the outside, though? Is it gravity? Are they just hanging there?
Well, it's actually the velocity of the parts. So if they were stationary, then they'd fall into Saturn straight away. But because they've got so much speed, it counteracts the force of gravity.
So they're just spinning and spinning and spinning. Why do they never slow down?
Well, there's no resistance to motion in space, so there's nothing to slow them down.
Right, let's find out what sciencey stuff has been in the news this week. Researchers have published the most accurate map of the dark matter in the universe there's ever been. Now, dark matter is one of the biggest mysteries in the universe. Scientists know it's there, they don't know what it is, but they're sure it exists. And they've studied 26 million galaxies to make this new map. In other news, a genetic analysis of the world's toughest creature has shown its survival secrets. Tardigrades often live in ponds. They survive radiation, dehydration, freezing, and even living in a space vacuum. And scientists have found out the millimeter-long creature could survive any disaster possible. And finally, a team of astronomers have potentially discovered the first known moon beyond the solar system. The exomoon is the same size as Neptune. It orbits a planet that is the same size as Jupiter, but has 10 times the mass. And it was found using NASA's Kepler telescope. So we'll get more science in the news for you next week. Right now, we're doing our own research to see who is truly better, humans or animals.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
You join us just as the competition is about to begin. We're pitting man against animal once again in our Extreme Athlete Challenge. So who can scale the heights to be the highest jumper on the planet? First to compete is Javier Sotomayor from Cuba, who set the world high jump record in 1993. And waiting his turn is the kangaroo rat, although I'm assured he's actually a rodent, not a marsupial.
He's about the size of a small cat and normally lives in sandy hot places like Arizona and Mexico and uses his quick reflexes to escape from predators.
Javier Sotomayor to jump first. He's taking a run-up. And what an amazing jump. He's cleared 8 feet.
That's over a foot taller than he is himself. What an achievement.
Now it's the turn of the kangaroo rat.
Astonishing! He's equaled Javier's 8 foot height and he's no more than a foot tall. That has to be an even more amazing achievement.
To have equaled this achievement, Javier would have had to have leapt over 160 metres in the air.
And I don't think even he would like to try that.
So let's hear it for the kangaroo rat, one of our extreme athletes.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
You can download all of our Man vs. Animal series for free on the Fun Kids app, on iTunes and at funkidslive.com. That is it then for another mind-melting and heartbreaking edition of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We're back next week with more answers from the universe's biggest questions. Oh, and speaking of questions, if you've got one that you want our resident expert, Engineer Tom, to answer, send it over to my page, quick as you can, over at funkidslive.com. There's loads more science stuff on there too, by the way. You can listen to all of our brilliant science series online on the free Fun Kids app, and you can download them as well for free on iTunes, and you can listen to Fun Kids on DAB digital radio across the UK on the free Fun Kids app and online at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.